Chapter 10. Kaushambi, Summer 530 AD. From the south bank of the Jamuna, Belisarius gazed at the temple rising from the very edge of the river on the opposite bank. It was sundown, and the last rays of the setting sun bathed the temple in golden glory. He was too distant to discern the details of the multitude of figurines carved into the tiered steps of the temple, but he did not fail to appreciate the beauty of the structure as a whole. "What a magnificent temple," he murmured. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Menander's lips tighten in disapproval. For a moment he thought to let it go, but then decided it was a fine opportunity to advance the young cataphract's education. "What's the matter, Menander?" he queried, cocking an eyebrow. "Does my admiration for heathen idolatry offend you?" The words were spoken in a mild and pleasant tone, but Menander flushed with embarrassment. "It's not my place," he began, but Belisarius cut him off. "Of course it is, lad. You're required to obey my orders as your commander. You are not required to agree with my theological opinions, so spit it out." He pointed to the temple. "What do you think of it? How can you deny its splendor?" Menander frowned. The expression was one of thought, not disapproval. He did not respond immediately, however. He and Belisarius had dismounted upon reaching the river in order to drink its water, and their horses were still assuaging their thirst. Idly, he stroked the neck of his horse for a few seconds before saying, "I can't deny that it's a beautifully made edifice, General. I just wish it had been made for some different purpose." Belisarius shrugged. "For what? Christian worship? That would be better, of course, to be sure. Unfortunately, Christian missionaries have only begun to penetrate this far into India's interior," with a smile of irony. "And all of them, alas, are Nestorian heretics. Not much better than outright heathens, according to most Orthodox churchmen, at least." He turned so as to face Menander squarely. "In the meantime, India's millions grope their own way toward God. That," pointing again to the temple, "is the proof of it. Would you rather they ignored God altogether?" Menander's frown deepened. "No," he said softly, after a moment. He hesitated, sighed, shrugged. "I've seen Dadaji praying in your tent many times, and I don't doubt his sincerity or his devotion. Another shrug, expressing a fatalistic acceptance of reality. "Wish you were praying to the Christian God?" Menander nodded. Belisarius looked back to the temple. Now he shrugged himself, but his was a cheerful shrug, expressing more of wonder than of resignation. "So do I, Menander, come down to it, but I can't say I lose any sleep over the matter. Dadaji's a true and pure soul. I don't think God will reject it when the time comes." The general glanced toward the west. The lower rim of the sun was almost touching the horizon. "We'd best head back," he said. "I'd hoped to get a glimpse of Kaushambi before nightfall, but I can see that we're still a few miles away from the outskirts." He and Menander mounted their horses and rode away from the river. As they headed back toward their camp, Menander said, "I thought you were Orthodox, sir." The youth's brow was furrowed in thought. Then, realizing that his statement might be construed amiss, Menander began to apologize. But his general dismissed the apology with a wave of the hand. "I am Orthodox." Then a crooked smile. "I suppose. I was raised so, as Thracians are, and it is the creed to which I have always subscribed." He hesitated. "It's hard to explain. I don't care much for such things, Menander. My wife, whom I love above all others in this world, is not Orthodox. For the sake of my reputation, she disguises her creed. But she inclines to Monophysitism, as do most Egyptians. Am I to believe that she is condemned to eternal hellfire?" He glanced at Menander. The young cataphract winced. If anything, Menander was even more adoring of Antonina than were most of the Bucellarii. Belisarius shook his head. "I think not. Not by the Christ I worship. And it is not simply she, Menander. I am a general, and I have led soldiers into battle who believed in every heresy, even Arians, and watched them die bravely, and held them in my arms as they died, listening to their last prayers. Were those men predestined for damnation? I think not. His jaws tightened. My indifference to creed goes deeper than that. Years ago, in my first command, I was only 18 years old, I matched wits with a Persarmenian commander named Veranes. His forces were small, as were mine, and our combat was prolonged over weeks, a thing of maneuver and feint as much as battle. He was a magnificent commander and taxed me to the utmost. He took a deep breath. An honorable and gallant foe as well, as Medians often are. Once I was forced to abandon three of my men. They were too badly wounded to move, and Veranes had caught me in a trap from which I had to extricate myself immediately or suffer total defeat. When he came upon them, Veranes saw to it that they were all well cared for. He looked away. For a moment the usual calm of his face seemed to waver, but not for long, and Belisarius resumed his tale. Menander was listening with rapt attention. I discovered the fact after I defeated Veranes. I trapped him myself, finally, and overran his camp. My three men were still there. One of them had died in the meantime from his wounds, but it was through no fault of the Persians. The other two were safe, thanks to Veranes. Veranes himself was mortally wounded from a lance thrust to the groin. It took him hours to die, and I spent those hours with him. I attempted to comfort him as best I could, but the wound was terrible. It must have been pure agony for him, but he bore it well. He even joked with me, and we passed the time discussing, among other things, our relative assessment of our previous weeks in combat. He had had the upper hand through most of it, but I had learned quickly. He predicted a great future for me. Belisarius paused for a moment, guiding his horse through a narrowing of the trail. Within a few seconds they passed through the final line of trees which bordered the river. Now, in more open country, the general resumed his tale. By the time he finally died, night had fallen. He was a Zoroastrian, as most Persians, a fire worshipper. He asked me to make a fire for him so that he might die looking into the face of his god. I did so unwillingly. A churchman, most churchmen at least, would have denounced me for that act of impiety. The Zoroastrian, a churchman would have no doubt explained, was soon enough going to get fire aplenty in the pit of eternal damnation. But I did not think Veranes was so destined. I did not think so then. I do not think so now. Menander, watching his general, was struck by the sudden coldness in his gaze. Belisarius's brown eyes were normally quite warm, except in battle. Even in battle, those eyes were not cold. Simply calm, detached, observant. The customary warmth returned within a few seconds, however. Musingly, Belisarius added, I tried to explain to Rao once, as best I could, the subtleties of the Trinity. He waved his hand. Not in this world, but in the world of my vision. Menander, already fascinated with his general's unwontedly intimate tale, now became totally absorbed. He knew of that vision which had come to Belisarius from the jewel which Bishop Cassian had brought him the year before in Aleppo. Belisarius had told him the tale, along with the other Romans and Ethiopians, while they were still at sea. Menander glanced at the general's chest. Beneath the half-armor and the tunic there was nothing to see. But the young cataphract knew that the talisman of God was there, nestled in a little pouch which Belisarius always carried suspended from his neck. Menander had even seen it himself, for Belisarius had showed it to them all in the cramped confines of their cabin in the Malwa embassy vessel which had brought them to India. He had dazzled them, then, by the mystic splendor of the talisman. He was dazzled now by the memory. Belisarius suddenly laughed. Rao listened to my explanation quite patiently, he continued, but it was obvious he thought it was child's babble. Then he told me that his own faith believed there were 330 million gods and goddesses, all of whom, in one way or another, were simply manifestations of God himself. Belisarius smiled his crooked smile. No doubt that man is doomed, but I will tell you this, Menander. I would rather stand with Raghunath Rao in the pit than with the patriarch Ephraim in heaven. Belisarius spoke no further during the rest of their ride back to camp. Menander also was silent, grappling with thoughts which were new to him, and which went far beyond the simple preachings of his village priest. They reached the grove within which the Romans and Ethiopians had pitched their camp. Still preoccupied, Menander gave only cursory attention to the task of guiding his horse through the trees, but once they broke through into the clearing at the center of the grove, all thoughts of theology vanished.
"There's trouble, Menander," said his general softly.
The moment Belisarius rode into the little clearing, he knew something was amiss. Azana and Wasi were both standing guard in front of Prince Aeon's pavilion. Normally only one or the other assumed that duty at any given time. What was even more noticeable was that the two Sarwan were actually standing guard. Usually the Sarwan on duty relaxed on a stool. There was no reason not to. For many weeks now, the Romans and Ethiopians had been guarded by their Kushan escorts, a group of over 30 men who were consummate professionals in their trade, and particularly expert at maintaining security. There was obvious tension in the pose of the Ethiopian soldiers. They weren't just standing. They were standing alertly, poised and ready. Quickly, Belisarius scanned the clearing. The lighting was poor. Dusk was almost a memory now, only a faint tinge of dark purple on the horizon. The sun itself had disappeared, and what little daylight still remained was blocked off by the trees surrounding the camp. For all practical purposes, the only illumination in the clearing was that cast by lanterns hanging from tent poles. His next glance was toward the two Roman tents situated not far from Prince Aeon's large pavilion. Both Valentinian and Anastasius, he noticed, were standing in front of them, much like the Sarwan, alert, poised, tense. Next, he stared across the clearing to the line of tents which marked the Kushan part of the encampment. Normally, at this time of the evening, the Kushans would have been busy preparing their evening meal. Instead, they were gathered in small clusters, murmuring quietly, casting quick glances at Prince Aeon's pavilion, and most of all, at the figure of their own commander. Belisarius now examined Kungus. The Kushan commander was standing alone. As always, now more than ever it seemed to Belisarius, his face appeared to have been hammered out of an iron ingot. Kanishka, his nephew and second in command, stood not far away. From what little Belisarius could discern of his features, the young Kushan lieutenant seemed distressed. Kungus met his gaze. The Kushan said nothing, and there was not the slightest movement in that iron mask of a face, but Belisarius did not miss the almost imperceptible shrug of his shoulders. He knew what had happened then. The sight of Garmat emerging from Aeon's pavilion and hurrying toward him simply confirmed the knowledge.
"All good things come to an end," he sighed, dismounting from his horse.
By the time Garmat reached him, Menander was leading both of the horses away.
"We have a problem, Belisarius," said Garmat urgently. "A very big problem."
Belisarius smiled crookedly.
"It couldn't last forever, Garmat. The Kushans are not stupid. To a point, of course, they will obey Kungus and ask no questions, but only to a point."
He gave the Kushans another glance.
"What happened?" he asked.
Garmat shrugged.
"You can hardly expect vigorous young people like Aeon and Shakuntala, royalty to boot, to share a tent week after week with no opportunity for exercise or even movement without—"
He sighed. Belisarius nodded.
"They quarreled."
Garmat smiled faintly.
"Oh, yes, a royal quarrel. What started it, I have no idea. They don't even remember themselves now, but soon enough Aeon became overbearing, and the princess, empress, I should say, challenged him to single combat. Unarmed combat, of course. If he used weapons, she told him, he would be damned for eternity as a coward."
For all the seriousness of the moment, Belisarius could not help bursting into laughter. The image which came to his mind was incongruously funny. Aeon, Prince of Aksum, was not a tall man, but he was amazingly well-muscled and as strong as a bull, whereas Shakuntala was a small girl, not half his weight. And yet, she had been trained to fight with her bare hands and feet by Raghunath Rao himself. Raghunath Rao, the panther of Maharashtra, the wind of the great country, India's most deadly assassin, among other things. He shook his head with amusement. I wonder how it would have turned out. They didn't actually come to blows, I hope. Garmar shook his head.
They are young and impetuous, but they are not insane. I gather that Shakuntala's challenge produced a sudden change of atmosphere in the tent. By the time I entered, they were exchanging profuse apologies and vows of goodwill. He tugged his beard. Unfortunately, in the brief moments before that change of atmosphere, the environs of their pavilion were filled with the sound of loud and angry voices. And Shakuntala has quite a distinctive voice, you know, especially when raised in anger. Grudgingly, even admiringly, a very imperial voice, in fact.
Belisarius scratched his chin. The Kushans heard her, he announced. Garmat nodded. Belisarius glanced at the Kushan soldiers again. They were still clustered in little knots, but to his relief they did not give the appearance of men on the verge of leaping into action. That momentary relief, however, cleared the way for another concern. Belisarius scanned the woods surrounding the clearing. As always, whenever possible, Belisarius had made their camp within a grove of trees. He had explained that preference to the Malwa casually as a matter of the comfort which the trees provided from the blistering sun of India. The Malwa, for their part, had made no objection. They were happy enough for their own reasons to see the foreigners secluded. Privately, the Malwa thought the outlanders were idiots. True, trees provided shade, but a good pavilion did as much, and trees also stifled the breeze and were a haven for obnoxious insects. The Malwa had also thought, happily, that trees would provide a haven for spies. As Belisarius watched, Usanas appeared from the edge of the trees and padded into the clearing. The hunter was casually wiping blood from the huge blade of his spear.
No Malwa spies now, thought Belisarius. His lips quirked into that distinctive crooked smile.
Usanas was a slave of sorts, of a very, very odd sort. The tall African was not Ethiopian. Like the Aksumites, his skin was black, but Usanas's broad features had not a trace of the aquiline characteristics which distinguished those of most Ethiopians. He came from a land between great lakes, which was, so Belisarius had been told, some considerable distance south of the kingdom of Aksum. He was the personal slave of Prince Aeon, his dewaz, as the Aksumites called his position, an advisor of a sort, a very, very odd sort. When Usanas reached Belisarius, he nodded curtly. The general noted that the hunter's usual beaming grin was entirely absent.
No spies now, said Usanas softly. He jerked his head toward the tent. Let us go in, he growled. I must advise, fool boy.
Usanas stalked toward the pavilion entrance, Garmat trailing in his wake like a remora trailing a shark. Belisarius felt a moment's pity for the young prince. The dewaz, when he felt it appropriate, was given to stern measures. Again, Belisarius quickly scanned the clearing. His own three cataphracts were now fully armed and armored, and their expressions were every bit as grim as those of the Sarwen. Belisarius caught the eye of Valentinian and made a subtle motion with his hands. Valentinian relaxed slightly and muttered something to Anastasius and Menander. The cataphracts maintained their watchfulness, but they eased away from their former tension. Belisarius now concentrated his attention on the Kushans, gauging their mood. The Malwa vassals were also armed and obviously tense, but they too seemed willing to allow the situation to unfold before taking any decisive steps. They were angry, true, so much was obvious. Angry at their commander for the most part, Belisarius thought, but they were also confused and uncertain. Kungus was their commander, after all, and it was a position which he had earned on 100 battlefields. And, too, they were all related by blood, members of the same clan banded together in service to the Malwa overlords, an unhappy and thankless service. Hard years had taught the Kushans to trust themselves alone, and most of all to trust their commander. Such habits cannot be overcome in an instant. Belisarius gauged and pondered the angles and made his decision. As always, the decision was quick. He strode across the clearing and planted himself before the Kushans.
Wait, he commanded. I must go into the pavilion. Make no decisions until I return.
The Kushans stiffened. The Roman general's words had been spoken in fluent Kushan. They knew his command of their language was good, but now it was perfect and unaccented. A few of them cast glances toward the trees. Belisarius smiled, broadly, not crookedly. There were no spies, not anymore. The Kushans had also seen Usanas emerge from the woods, and if they did not know of the African's extraordinary skill as a hunter, they had never misunderstood the easy manner in which he handled the huge spear which was his ever-present companion. Imperceptibly, they began to relax. Just a bit. Melisarius glanced at Kungus. The Kushan commander nodded slightly. The Roman general wheeled and headed toward the pavilion. As he turned, he caught sight of Dadaji Holker standing near the pavilion. Though middle-aged and unarmed and a slave, the man was obviously prepared to help defend the pavilion against assault. Belisarius did not smile, but he felt a great affection surge into his heart. "Come," he commanded as he strode by Holker. "I suspect you already know the truth, but you may as well see for yourself." As they entered the pavilion, Usanas was just warming to his subject.
"Be forced to tell Nagusa Nagasti to better to drown his fool boy in the sea and beget another. The Kuan Sao would be furious with me. Beat me for failing in my duty. But I bear up under the regiment's savage blows with great cheer, knowing I finally rid of hopeless task of teaching frog-level intelligence to worm-brained prince."
"No, attack him," snapped Shakuntala. "Was my wrongdoing."
The girl spoke in Giez and had Usanas. Her command of the language of the Aksumites was still poor, heavily accented, and broken, but she understood enough to have followed Usanas's tirade. The young woman was sitting cross-legged on a plush cushion to one side of the pavilion. Her posture was stiff and erect. For all her youth and her small size, she exuded a tremendous imperial dignity. Usanas scowled. He was not impressed by royalty. Aksumites in general, and Usanas in particular, shared none of the Indian awe of rulership. Usanas himself was a Diwaz, assigned the specific task of instructing a prince in the simple truth that the difference between a king and a slave was not so great, a matter of luck in its origin and brains in its maintenance. The Diwaz switched to Hindi, which was the common language used by all in the pavilion.
"Next time, Empress," he growled, "do not challenge Cretan prince to combat. Simply pounce upon him like lioness and beat him senseless. Fool girl."
Usanas shook his head sadly.
"True, royalty is stupid by nature. But this is not stupidity. This,
he groaned woefully.
"There is no word for this. Not even in Greek, language of philosophy, which has words for every silliness known to man."
Aeon, squatting on his cushion, raised his bowed head. The young prince, 19, he was but a year or so older than Shakuntala, attempted to regain some measure of his own royal dignity.
"Stop speaking pidgin," he commanded.
Belisarius fought down a grin. He knew Usanas's rejoinder even before the Diwaz spoke the words.
"Not speaking pidgin. Speaking baby talk, all fool prince can understand."
When Belisarius had first met Usanas, the year before in Constantinople, the African had spoken nothing but a bizarre, broken argot. Usanas had maintained that manner of speech for months, until the alliance which Belisarius sought between Romans and Ethiopians had finally gelled, following a battle with pirates in the Erythraean Sea. Then, at the prince's command, Usanas had stopped pretending he spoke only pidgin Greek. The Romans had been astonished to discover that the outlandish African was an extraordinary linguist who spoke any number of languages fluently, especially Greek, which was a language Usanas treasured, for he was fond of philosophical discourse and debate, to Anastasius's great pleasure and the despair of his other companions. Usanas now launched into a savage elaboration of the ontological distinction between ignorance and stupidity.
"Ignorance can be fixed. Stupid is forever. Consider, fool boy, the fate of—"
"Enough," commanded Belisarius. Usanas clamped his jaws shut. Then,
"I was just warming to my subject," he complained sourly.
Yes, I know. Save it for another time, Musanas. The Gushans will not wait that long. The general jerked his head toward the pavilion entrance. We have to solve this problem quickly. Aeon suddenly blew out his cheeks, his massive shoulders hunched. What do they know? He asked. He was looking at no one in particular. Garmada answered. They know that Shakuntala is here in this tent, tonight. The advisor squatted himself now and stared at his prince from a distance of a few feet. That is all that they know, he continued, but they are not stupid. They will also understand that she must have been with us ever since the massacre at Venandakatra's palace at Gwalior. They will understand that she did not flee with Raghunath Rao. They will understand that Rao led the Malwa on a merry chase while the Empress herself was smuggled into your entourage, and that we have hidden her ever since. He sighed. And most of all, they will now understand the reason why Kungas told them to pester our women these past weeks. Pester them, but not seriously, just enough to trigger off phony brawls with our cataphracts and Sawen. Brawls which accidentally mangled some spies and led the survivors to report that our escorts are every bit as salacious as Venandakatra has been led to believe. Garmat glanced at Belisarius, shrugged. As I said, the Kushans are not stupid. By now they will have heard that the reason they were withdrawn as Shakuntala's guards was because Venandakatra feared their lustfulness, and so he replaced them with Mahami Mamsa, who fell like sheep when Rao entered the palace and rescued the Empress. The advisor stroked his beard. So they will suspect that Belisarius engineered the entire thing from the very beginning. Although, here he smiled, they probably do not know that Belisarius gave Rao the very dagger which he used to carve up the torturers. In other words, grumbled Usanas, they know everything. Yes, stated Belisarius. And worst of all, it is obvious from looking at them, they know that their own commander must have been part of the scheme, in some sense at least. They have no love for the Malwa, but they are still sworn to their service. Now they find they have been betrayed by their own leader. If the Malwa discover the Empress now, their own lives will be forfeit. The general took a deep breath. Unless they immediately recapture her and hand Shakuntala back to their overlords. They would have to turn over Kungas as well, protested Aeon. The Malwa would never believe Kungas had not spotted Shakuntala. Belisarius nodded. Yes, I'm sure they understand that also, and that is why they hesitate. He glanced toward the pavilion entrance again. They will hesitate for a while, but not for all that long. Those men are soldiers, the best of soldiers, accustomed to hard and quick decisions, and accustomed to stern necessity and to the realities of a bitter world. So we must somehow figure out. Shakuntala interrupted. Bring them into the pavilion. All of them. Now. Belisarius started. Not even the Roman Emperor Justinian, not even the Empress Theodora, could match that tone of command.
That incredibly imperial voice.
He stared at the girl. Shakuntala was very beautiful in her exotic and dark-skinned way, but at that moment it was not a girl's beauty, but the beauty of an ancient statue. And that's the key, he mused. Justinian and Theodora, for all their power, were low-born. How many emperors of Rome over the centuries could trace their ancestry back to royalty more than a generation or two? None. Whereas the Satavahana dynasty, which ruled Andhra, Great Andhra, he said aloud. Broken Andhra now. But even the fierce Bedouin of the desert are awed by the broken Sphinx. Shakuntala stared up at him. The general scratched his chin. Are you certain of this course, Empress? He asked. He glanced at the others in the pavilion. From the puzzled frowns on their faces, it was obvious that only Belisarius had discerned Shakuntala's purpose. He wasn't surprised. Her proposed move was bold almost beyond belief. She nodded firmly. There is no other course possible, Belisarius. And besides, she took a deep breath, regality blazed. It is the only course open to the honor of Andhra. Any other would be foulness. She made a short, chopping gesture. Let the Malwa rule so. I will not. The frowns surrounding the Empress and the General were deepening by the second. No others in the pavilion, it was obvious, had any understanding of what she was planning. Belisarius smiled crookedly and bowed. As you command, Empress. He turned toward the entrance, then, struck by a thought, turned back. His smile was now very crooked. And there is this much also. We will learn if Rao's favorite saying is really true. A moment later, Belisarius was pulling back the flap of the pavilion. As he stooped to make his exit, he caught sight of Usanas. The tall African was gaping. But to Belisarius' surprise, Usanas was the first to deduce the truth. The gape disappeared, the familiar grin erupted.
Truly, Greeks are mad, exclaimed the Dawaz. It is the inevitable result of too much time spent pondering on the soul.
Belisarius grinned and exited the tent. As the flap closed behind him, he heard Usanas' next words.
Such foolish nonsense. This business about only the soul matters in the end. Idiot mysticism from a crazed Maratha bandit. No, no, it's all quite otherwise, my good people, I assure you. As Plato so clearly explained, it is the eternal and unchanging forms which...
Usanas, shut up, barked the prince. What in the hell is going on? When Belisarius re-entered the pavilion, leading the Kushans, he saw that Shakuntala had taken firm command of the situation. Darmat and Aeon were sitting on cushions placed to one side. Standing behind them were Ezana and Wasi. The two Sawen were carrying their spears, but were carefully holding them in the position of formal rest. It was obvious from their gloomy expressions that all the Aksumites thought Shakuntala's plan, agreed to by Belisarius, was utterly insane. But events had moved too quickly for them, and they were hopelessly ensnared in her madness. To the general's surprise, the Maratha women were not huddling in fear in a corner of the pavilion. They were kneeling in a row, on cushions placed just behind Shakuntala, who had positioned herself in the central and commanding position in the large pavilion. Belisarius was struck by the calm composure of the Maratha girls. As much as anything, the confident serenity of those young faces as they gazed upon their even younger empress brought Belisarius his own measure of confidence. He glanced at Usanas, standing in the nearest corner of the pavilion, and saw by his faint smile that the hunter shared that confidence. Not so many weeks ago, those girls had been slaves, of low-born caste, and then, after the Malwa conquest of Andhra, forced into prostitution. The Roman and Aksumite soldiers had purchased them in Barakucha, partly for the pleasure of their company, but mostly to advance Belisarius' scheme for rescuing Shakuntala. At first the girls had been timid. Over time, as they learned that the foreigner's brutal appearance was not matched by brutal behavior, the Maratha girls had relaxed. But once they finally realized the full scope of the scheme into which they had been plunged, they had been practically paralyzed with terror. Until Shakuntala had rallied them and pronounced them her new royal ladies-in-waiting and pledged that she herself would share their fate, whatever that fate might be. He glanced now at Dadaji Holkar. The Maratha was also seated near the Empress, just to her left. He was still clad in the simple loincloth of a slave, but there was nothing of the slave in his posture and his expression. The shrewd intelligence in his face, usually disguised by his stooped posture, was now evident for all to see. The man positively exuded the aura of a highly placed, trusted imperial advisor. And if the aura went poorly with the loincloth, so much the worse for the loincloth. Indians, too, like Romans, had a place in their culture for the ascetic sage. Calm, confident, serene faces. The Kushans, as they filed into the tent, caught sight of those faces and found their eyes drawn toward them. As Shakuntala had planned, Belisarius knew. The young empress had marshaled all her resources, few as they were, to project the image of a ruler rather than a refugee. It was a fiction, but not a sham. Not a sham at all. By the time all the Kushans filed in, even the huge pavilion was crowded. Then, when the cataphracts followed, Belisarius thought the pavilion might burst at the seams. Shakuntala took charge. Sit, she commanded. All of you except Usanas. She looked at Usanas. Search the woods. Make certain there are no spies. The Dawaz grinned.
The order was utterly redundant, of course.
He had already seen to the task, but he knew Shakuntala was simply seeking to calm the Kushans, so he obeyed instantly and without complaint. On his way out of the pavilion, he whispered to Belisarius,
Envy me, Roman. I at least will be able to breathe.
The Kushans were still standing, uncertain. Sit, commanded Shakuntala. Within 3 seconds, all had obeyed, but as they made to do so, she spoke again. Kungus, sit here. Shakuntala pointed imperiously to one of the two cushions placed not far from her own, diagonally to her right. Remembering the seating arrangement in the Mawa Emperor's pavilion, Belisarius realized this was the Indian way of honoring those close to the throne. She pointed to the other cushion. Kanishka, there. The Kushan commander and his lieutenant did as she bade them. After all the Kushans were sitting on the carpeted floor of the pavilion, Shakuntala gazed upon them for a long moment without speaking. The warriors stared back at her. They knew her face well, of course. It had been they who had rescued Shakuntala from the Yetai savaging the royal palace during the sack of Amaravati. They who had brought her to Venantakatra's palace in Gwalior, where she was destined to become the Malwa lord's new concubine. They who had served as her captors and guardians during the long months they waited for Venantakatra's return from his mission to Constantinople. Yet for all the familiarity of those months in her company, most of them were now gaping. Surprise, partly, at seeing her again in such unexpected circumstances, but mostly with surprise at how different she seemed. This was no captive girl, proud and defiant, true, but riddled with despair for all that. This was what? Or who? The moment was critical, Belisarius knew. There had been no time to discuss anything with her. He feared that in her youthful uncertainty she would make the mistake of explaining the situation, of trying to convince the Kushans. The Empress Shakuntala, heir of ancient Satavahana, rightful ruler of Great Andhra, began to speak. And Belisarius realized he might as well have fretted over the sun rising. Soon I will return to Andhra, announced Shakuntala. My purpose here is almost finished. When I return, I shall rebuild the empire of my ancestors. I shall restore its glory. I shall cast down the Mahaveda abomination and erase from human memory their Mahamimamsa curse. I shall rebuild the Viharas and restore the stupas. Again, I shall make Andhra the blessed center of Hindu learning and Buddhist worship. She paused. The black-eyed pearl of the Satavahanas, she was often called. Now her eyes glowed like coals. But first I must destroy the Malwa Empire. To this I devote my life and my sacred soul. This is my dharma, my duty, and my destiny. I will make Malwa howl. Again a pause. The black fury in her eyes softened. Already Raghunath Rao is making his way back to the great country. The wind will roar across Maharashtra. He will raise a new army from the hills and the villages and the great towns. He is the new commander of Andhra's army. She allowed the Kushans time to digest her words. The men sitting before her were elite soldiers, hardened veterans. They knew Raghunath Rao. Like all Indians, they knew him by reputation. But unlike most, their knowledge was more intimate. They had seen the carnage at the palace at Gwalior, after the panther of Maharashtra had raged through it. Shakuntala watched pride square their shoulders. She treasured that pride. She was counting on that pride. Yes, the Kushan soldiers knew Rao and respected him deeply, but their pride came from the knowledge that he had respected them as well. For Rao had not tried to rescue the princess while they had guarded her. He had waited until they had been replaced by... Shakuntala watched the contempt twisting their lips. She treasured that contempt. She was counting on that contempt. The Kushans today were elite soldiers in the service of the Mawa Empire, but they were also the descendants of those fierce nomads who had erupted out of Central Asia centuries before and had conquered all of Bactria and Sogdiana and northern India. Conquered it, ruled it, and as they adopted civilization and the Buddhist faith, ruled it very well indeed, until the Yetai came and the Malwa and reduced them to vassalage. For a long moment, Shakuntala and the Kushans stared at each other. Watching from the back of the pavilion, Belisarius was struck by the growing warmth of that mutual regard. She and they had spent many months in close proximity, and if during that long and painful captivity there had been no friendship between them, there had always been respect, a respect which, over time, had become unspoken admiration. Now, thought Belisarius, as if she had read his mind, Shakuntala spoke. Rao will raise my army, but I will need another force as well. I, too, will need to tread a dangerous path. I will need an imperial bodyguard to protect me while I restore Andra. She looked away, said softly, I have given much thought to this matter. I have considered many possibilities, but always my thoughts return to one place and one place only. She looked back upon them. I can think of no better men to serve as my bodyguard than those who rescued me from the Yetai and guarded me so well during all the months at Gwalior. Behind him, Belisarius heard Menander's shocked whisper.
My God, she's crazy. Bullshit, hissed Valentinian. She's read them perfectly.
And then Anastasius, his rumbling voice filled with philosophical satisfaction.
Never forget, lad. Only the soul matters in the end.
One of the Kushans, seated in the middle of the front row, now spoke. Belisarius did not know the man's name, but he recognized him as a leader of the Kushan common soldiers, the equivalent of a Roman decarch.
We must know this, princess.
She's not a princess, snapped one of the Maratha women kneeling behind Shakuntala. Ahilyabai was her name. She is the Empress of Andhra. The Kushan soldier tightened his jaws. Shakuntala raised her hand in an abrupt gesture of command. Be still, Ahilyabai. My title does not matter to this man. She leaned forward, fixing the Kushan with her black-eyed gaze. His name is Kujalo, and I know him well. If Kujalo chooses to give me his loyalty, my title will never matter to him. Whether I sit on the throne in rebuilt Amaravati, or crouch behind the battlements of a Maratha hill fort under siege, Kujalo's sword will always come between me and Malwa. The soldier's tight jaws relaxed. His shoulders spread wider. He stared back at the Empress for a moment and then bowed his head deeply.
Ask what you will, Kujalo, said Shakuntala.
The Kushan soldier raised his head. Anger returned to his eyes and he pointed to Kungus.
We have been played for fools, he growled. Was our commander a part of that trickery?
Shakuntala's response was immediate. No. This is the first time Kungus has been in my presence since you were removed as my guards at Gwalior. I have never spoken to him since that day.
Her voice grew harsh.
But what is the purpose of this question, Kujalo? You have not been played for fools. The Malwa have been the ones played for fools, and not by me, but by the world's supreme trickster, the foreign general Belisarius.
All the Kushans stirred, turning their heads. Belisarius took that for his cue and moved forward to stand before them.
Kungus has never been a part of our plot, he said firmly, nor any other Kushan soldier.
He smiled then, and the Kushans who saw that odd familiar smile suddenly understood just how crooked it truly was.
Actually, he continued, the trickery was needed because of you. There was no way for Rao to rescue the princess so long as you stood guard over her. Even for him, that task was impossible.
He paused, letting the pride of that knowledge sweep the Kushans. Like Shakuntala, he knew full well that their own self-respect was the key to winning these men.
So I convinced Venandakatra, or so I'm told, I was very drunk that night and remember little of our conversation, that Kushans were the most depraved men walking the earth. Satyrs, the lot of them, with a particular talent for seducing young virgins. A little laugh rippled through the Kushans. Apparently my words reached receptive ears. The general scratched his chin. I feared Lord Venandakatra is perhaps too willing to believe the worst of other men. It might be better to say to assume that other men are shaped in his own mold.
A much louder laugh filled the pavilion. A cheerful laugh at the folly of a great lord. A bitter laugh, for that lord was not called the Vile One by accident. Belisarius shrugged. The rest you know. You were unceremoniously dismissed as Shakuntala's guards and replaced by Mahaveda priests and Mahamimamsa torturers. It was they who faced the Panther of Maharashtra when he stalked through the palace. All trace of humor vanished. Now the Roman general's face seemed every bit as hard as the iron face of Kungus. The dagger which the Panther used to spill the lives of those Malwa beasts came from my own country. An excellent dagger made by our finest craftsmen. I brought it with me to India and saw to it that it found its way into Rao's hands. His face softened slightly, with a trace of its usual humor returning. The Malwa, as we planned, thought that the princess had fled with Rao, and so they sent thousands of Rajputs beating around the countryside. But Rao was alone, and so was able to elude them. We knew the Empress would not have the skill to do so, so, as we had planned, Rao left her behind in the palace, hidden in a closet in the guest quarters. When we arrived, 2 days later, we hid her among Prince Aeon's concubines. He looked down at Kungus. The Kushan commander returned his stare with no expression on his face. Kungus knew nothing of this, no more than any of you. It is true, on the day we left Gwalior for Ranipur, I believe that he recognized the Empress as we were smuggling her into Prince Aeon's howdah. I'm not certain, however, for he said nothing to me, nor I to him, nor have we spoken on the matter since. But I believe that he did recognize her, and for his own reasons chose to remain silent. Kujalo stared at his commander. Is this true? He demanded. Kungus nodded. Yes. It is exactly as the Roman says. I knew nothing about their scheme, but I did recognize Shakuntala. On the day we left Gwalior for Ranipur, just as he says. Why did you remain silent? Demanded Kujalo. That question you may not ask, replied Kungus. His tone, if possible, was even harder than his face. You may question my actions, Kujalo, and demand an accounting of them, but you may not question me. Kujalo shrank back slightly. All the Kushans seemed to shrink. Kungus dismissed the question with a curt chop. Besides, it is a stupid question. Your decision tonight may be different, Kujalo, but do not pretend you don't understand my own. If you really need to ask that question, you are no kinsman of mine. His iron eyes swept the Kushans. Any of you? A little sigh swept the pavilion. Suddenly, one of the Kushan soldiers toward the rear barked a little laugh. And why not? He demanded. I'm sick of the Malwa. Sick of their arrogance and the barks of Yetai dogs and the sneers of Rajputs. Another Kushan grunted his agreement. A third said softly, We are destined to die anyway. Better to die an honored imperial bodyguard than a Malwa beast of burden. I'll have none of that talk, growled Kungus. There is no destiny. There is only the edge of a good blade and the skill of the man wielding it. Quietly, at that moment, Usanas re-entered the pavilion. He was just in time to hear Kujalo's remark. And the brains of the man commanding the soldiers. The Kushan laughed then, in genuine good humor. Looking at the Empress, he nodded toward Belisarius. This man, I take it, is one of your allies, Empress. Kujalo paused, took a breath, made his decision. One of our allies now. A quick collective exhalation indicated that all the Kushan soldiers accepted the decision. Kujalo continued. He's a great schemer and trickster, that's for certain. But trickery will only take us so far. Is he good for anything else? Shakuntala reared up haughtily. In the corner of his eye, Belisarius saw his own cataphracts stiffen with anger. He began to say something, but then, seeing Usanas saunter forward, relaxed. Kushan soldier, very great fool, remarked the Dawaz cheerfully. Probably asks pigeons how to eat meat, and crocodiles how to fly. The African hunter planted himself before Kujalo, gazing down at the Kushan soldier. Kujalo craned his neck, returning the gaze. Anger at Usanas's ridicule began to cloud his face. Why ask this question from the Empress of Andhra? Demanded Usanas.
would she know of such things? Better to ask the Persians who survived Minduas.
Anger faded, replaced by interest. Kujalo glanced at Belisarius.
He has defeated Medes?
Like all warriors from Central Asia who had clashed with the Persian Empire for centuries, Kujalo held Persian heavy cavalry in deep respect.
Routed an entire army of the bastards, snarled Valentinian from the back of the pavilion. Just last year. You might ask the Goths for their opinion, too, while you're at it, rumbled Manastasius. He's whipped the barbarians so many times they finally asked him to be their king. Couldn't figure out any other way to beat him.
The giant Thracian yawned.
He refused. No challenge to it, he said.
Kujalo eyed the Roman general with keen interest. He had never heard of Goths, but he had faced other barbarians in battle.
So, he mused, we are now the imperial bodyguard of the Satavahana dynasty, with nothing but Raghunath Rao as the general of a non-existent army and this Belisarius as an ally.
Kujalo grinned. In that wolf's grin, at that moment, centuries of civilization vanished. The warrior of the steppes shone forth.
Pity the poor Malwa, exclaimed one of the other Kushan soldiers.
Kujalo's grin widened still.
Better yet, he countered. Let us pity them not at all.